FSR. We're out of time. Author of No More War, Daniel Kovalik out of Pittsburgh, and director of Risalat Strategic Institute, Samahdi Torabi out of Qom. Appreciate both of you being with us. And as always, we appreciate you staying with us on another debate. Bye-bye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
We draw your attention to verses 54 and 55 of chapter Araf from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Inna رَبَّكُمُ اللَّهُ الَّذِي خَلَقَ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضَ فِي سِتَّةِ أَيَّامٍ خَلَقَ السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش يغشي الليل النهار يطلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك الله رب العالمين ادعوا ربكم تضرعا لكم تضرعا وخفية إنه لا يحب المعتدين. صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in six periods of time, and He is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly, and He created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by His command. Surely His is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the world. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely, He does not love those who exceed the limits.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
This hour's top stories. Iran says the only beneficiary of the U.S. assassination of General Qasem Soleimani is the Daesh terror group, which has increased its activity since then. Syrian media say 9 civilians are killed and 4 injured in a terrorist attack in the city of Hama. So in the headlines, the UK government is under pressure to explain why some Saudi airstrikes in Yemen involving civilian casualties have been excluded from its log of humanitarian breaches. Welcome. Iran's foreign minister says the Daesh terror group has been the only beneficiary of the U.S. assassination of General Qasem Soleimani. Mohammad Javad Zarif made the comment on his Twitter page. He said Daesh has increased its activity since the top Iranian general was killed by the U.S. last January. Zarif said Soleimani was the main enemy of extremist terrorists. He said the top general was cowardly assassinated by what he called the terrorist-in-chief. People in several countries have marked the first anniversary of the U.S. assassination of General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Iraqis filled the streets of the capital, Baghdad, to mourn the martyrdom of the two anti-terror commanders. They called for the expulsion of U.S. forces from Iraq. Head of the battle organization, Hadi al-Amiri, addressed the crowd. He said the Iraqi people are the rightful owners of their country, not the United States. Amiri also stressed the necessity to avenge the killing of Soleimani and Muhandis. In Yemen, people hit the streets of the northern city of Sa'ada, demanding those behind the assassination to be brought to justice. Similar rallies also took place in other countries, including India and Canada. The Palestinian-Iranian Friendship Association has held a ceremony in Syria's capital, Damascus, to pay tribute to Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, who was assassinated by the U.S. in Iraq over a year ago. Our correspondent, Mohammed Ali, reports.
A ceremony attended by Syrians, Palestinians, Iranians, and Yemenis was held in Damascus to mark the first martyrdom anniversary of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Iran's ambassador to Syria asserted that the resistance front will continue to fight back against any aggression, reiterating the assassination was a sign of the weakness of the United States.
By firing the missile on General Soleimani, the U.S. targeted the Iranian people, their power, and pride. The U.S. wanted to thwart the resistance front's plans, but they failed. They have no choice but to leave the region.
Delegates from Syria's Ba'ath Arab Socialist Party and Yemen also delivered words on General Soleimani and his achievements in leading resistance fighters against the Western plots in the region. Vice Secretary General of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine said General Soleimani told him the only path to liberate Palestine was armed struggle and national unity between Palestinians.
General Soleimani urged us to depend on ourselves instead of others. Thanks to his efforts and advices, today we make weapons and the Palestinian resistance is currently in constant development.
Photos of General Soleimani were also exhibited showing moments of his missions across Syria and Iraq. For years, General Soleimani led Iranian military advisors in Syria at Syria's request and played a key role in defeating Daesh terrorists as well as restoring security to hundreds of square kilometers across the Arab country. For over a week, Syrians, Iranians, and Palestinians have commemorated General Soleimani's martyrdom. And as observers say, contrary to the U.S. and its regional allies' will, General Soleimani's assassination has further strengthened unity among all members of the resistance front. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have commemorated the first martyrdom anniversary of top Iranian commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and expressed gratitude to him for his contribution to the Palestinian cause. Ruba Shabit has a report from Gaza.
The first anniversary of the U.S. assassination of Iranian commander General Qasem Soleimani and his companions, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip came together to thank the general for his support in their struggle against the Israeli aggression.
The assassination of General Soleimani has not stopped Iran's support for the Palestinian cause. Our resistance will continue until the liberation of Al-Quds. The blood of General Soleimani will not go in vain. General Soleimani made a turning point in the history of the Palestinian cause.
Many Palestinian leaders and officials joined the mourners and expressed gratitude to Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, who was assassinated in a U.S. airstrike in Baghdad on January. Palestinians consider General Soleimani a symbol of resistance for all the oppressed Palestinians.
We stress that the resistance will continue till all Zionist plots are thwarted in the region. The path of General Soleimani will continue. His assassination has made us more determined to keep the resistance alive.
Palestinians stress that they will follow in the footsteps of General Soleimani, who had a major role in supporting the Palestinian resistance in different fields and making a big difference in the balance of deterrence and rules with the Zionist regime.
General Soleimani was assassinated because he was supporting the resistance front. He always cared about Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and Palestinians. His assassination has made us more united in our fight against the occupation.
Similar gatherings were held in other parts of the region to commemorate the Iranian top commander.
Palestinians here consider General Soleimani a symbol of resistance. They say they will continue his path of struggling against the Israeli occupation until the liberation of Palestine and Jerusalem Al-Quds. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Syrian media say a terrorist attack in the city of Hama has claimed the lives of 9 civilians and left 4 others injured. Governor of Hama province, Mohammed Tariq Krishati, also confirmed the attack on 3 buses and a fuel tanker. It was not immediately clear who was behind the act of violence. Last week, 28 people died in another attack that targeted a bus in the eastern Syrian province of Deir ez-Zor. Daesh terrorists claimed responsibility for that attack. Well, Daesh terrorists have also claimed responsibility for killing 11 minors from Pakistan's Shia Hazaras in the country's southwest. The terror group claimed the attack through Amar News Agency, via its telegram communications channel, the terrorists reportedly slit the throats of the miners after they were blindfolded with their hands tied behind their backs. The slaughter took place in the Bolan district southeast of Balochistan's province, or Balochistan's provincial capital of Quetta. Following the attack, members of the Hazara minority in Quetta took to the streets to protest the killings. The Hazara minority group, mind you, has frequently been targeted by terror groups in both Pakistan and Afghanistan. The UK government comes under pressure to explain why a series of airstrikes in Yemen have not been recorded in its confidential log of breaches of international humanitarian law. The Saudi airstrikes in question led to civilian casualties. The UK government is accused of not recording the attacks so that it could continue its arms exports to Saudi Arabia for use in Yemen, that is. As of last July, the British government recorded 500 possible breaches in Yemen. The parliamentary questions have established that a number of airstrikes in possible breach of international humanitarian law have not been included. Human rights groups have also said the true number of breaches should be much higher. The UK has supplied nearly $7 billion of weapons to the kingdom since the start of the Saudi war on its neighbor in 2015. Now, the Saudi-led coalition continues its violation of international humanitarian law against Yemeni prisoners. In 2020, more than 20 of these prisoners have lost their lives under torture. Our correspondent in Sana'a reports.
New crimes are added to the Saudi-led coalition's record violations of international law following the death of 22 Yemeni prisoners and the coalition's presence in 2020, all due to torture and medical neglect.
Torture has become a regular thing for the Saudi coalition, and unfortunately, these crimes are being frequent and vary from year to year. This year, 22 prisoners were killed either under torture or medical and food neglect. So we believe that there is an intention to get rid of the prisoners.
The head of Yemen's National Committee for Prisoners Affairs confirms that the UAE keeps hundreds of prisoners in its presence in southern Yemen, despite its refusal to attend any negotiations, while the United Nations has promised to attend amid the humanitarian nature of the prisoners' issue.
The Emiratis are an essential part of this aggression, and they are on the ground, and they have dozens of prisons in the lands they occupied here and in the Horn of Africa. We have asked the United Nations to bring the Emiratis for negotiations, but so far there is no response from them, and we are still waiting.
2020 witnessed remarkable progress in the liberation of 1,087 prisoners of the Yemeni army and the popular committees, 670 of whom were freed through UN mediation and the rest through local exchange deals.
The Saudi coalition's violations of international humanitarian laws are not only against the prisoners, but against the entire people of Yemen, who are the victims of an ongoing war on their country. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Nancy Pelosi has been narrowly re-elected Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives as a new Congress took office amid the country's political uncertainty. The House voted 216-209 to reinstate Pelosi after Democrats lost 11 seats in the 2020 November elections to command the narrower majority. The 80-year-old lawmaker from the state of California faced a scare when a handful of fellow Democrats defected and voted present during the floor vote. Pelosi, who has led the Democratic caucus for several years now, secured her fourth non-consecutive term as House Speaker. Political commentator Frank Emspach says if the U.S. Republicans hold the Senate, they will spend the following years doing anything to destroy Joe Biden's administration.
I think that the danger here for the Democrats and for the centrist Democrats is this. The people, they are claiming that they lost seats because centrist Democrats lost elections and they blamed the left. On the other hand, what we saw in the electoral process is that all of the most progressive members of the House of Representatives won their elections. It was the more conservative members of the House that lost, and then they blamed the left. So this puts Nancy Pelosi in a tough spot. The winners have been people who are more progressive than she. That's one problem. The second problem is it's pretty clear that if the Republicans hold the Senate, and it's very, very unlikely that Democrats will win two seats in Georgia, at this stage of the game, or any stage of the game, the Republicans are going to spend the next couple of years going after the Democrats, being disruptive, doing everything they can to destroy the Biden administration. And so that puts more pressure on Pelosi to find ways to unify the Democratic caucus in the House.
And now a leaked phone call reveals that the U.S. president has pressed the Georgia Secretary of State to overturn the 2020 presidential election results.
You know what they did, and you're not reporting it. That's a, you know, that's a criminal offense. And you know, you can't let that happen. That's a big risk to you and to Ryan, your lawyer. That's a big risk. But they are shredding ballots, in my opinion, based on what I've heard. And they are removing machinery, and they're moving it as fast as they can, both of which are criminal fines, and you can't let it happen, and you are letting it happen. You know, I mean, I'm notifying you that you're letting it happen. So, look, all I want to do is this. I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have, because we won the state.
The hour-long phone conversation between Trump and Brad Raffensperger was obtained by the Washington Post. In the audio, Trump reiterated his claim of voter fraud and irregularities in the U.S. state, which was repeatedly rejected by the Republican state official. His claims come as President-elect Joe Biden's victory in the state has already been certified by the Electoral College. A revelation also comes days ahead of the Congress's January the 6th meeting, when Biden's victory is expected to be officially certified. Over 100 lawmakers are set to contest the certification and try to change the results in favor of Trump. The U.S. president has once again lashed out at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, claiming the agency has exaggerated the COVID-19 pandemic in the country. Following Donald Trump's Twitter post, two top U.S. health officials disputed the claim. Infectious disease expert Anthony Fauci said the deaths, jam-packed hospitals, and stressed-out health workers are all real, while U.S. Surgeon General Jerome Adams defended the CDC. The comments come as cases of the coronavirus are skyrocketing in the U.S., with daily hospitalizations marking 1 month, or marking more than a month of being over 100,000, that should be. The U.S. has reported more than 351,000 deaths out of some 20.5 million confirmed cases so far. Vaccination is also underway in the country, but the government has come under criticism for the program's slow and chaotic process. Germany and the UK plan to extend existing lockdown restrictions as coronavirus cases keep rising in both countries. German Health Minister Jens Spahn says the number of infections are still too high. He says the country must prolong its lockdown restrictions to reduce the cases. The current curbs will remain in place until January the 10th. They came into effect before Christmas. Despite that, daily cases continue to rise in Germany. On Sunday, the country reported over 10,000 new infections and more than 300 new deaths. The virus has also surged in the UK, prompting the government to consider imposing stricter measures.
It may be that we need to do things in the next few weeks that will be tougher in many parts of the country. I'm fully reconciled to that. What we're doing clearly is grappling with a new variant of the virus, which is surging particularly in London and the southeast, and that's why we've had to take exceptional measures for some parts.
The British Premier said his country will go ahead with its COVID vaccination program. On Sunday, Britain registered nearly 55,000 new cases. That is the sixth day in a row that daily infections have remained above 50,000 there. New fatalities also topped 450. Daily infections and deaths have rapidly increased in Britain after a new COVID strain surfaced there last month. Officials say the variant spreads far more quickly.
Thank you. diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually, and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makes the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
The limelight.
BioNTech has criticized the EU's failure to order more doses of its coronavirus vaccine, saying it is now racing with its US partner, Pfizer, to boost production amid fears of a European gap left by the lack of other approved vaccines. The Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine was the first to be approved by the bloc late last month, after being accepted by the United Kingdom, Canada, and the United States. They and other countries have also since approved the Moderna or Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine, leaving the European Union trailing behind. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnists John Henley, Kate Connolly, and Kim Wilshire. The piece is titled, BioNTech Criticizes EU Failure to Order Enough COVID Vaccine. BioNTech has criticized the EU's failure to order more doses of its coronavirus vaccine, saying it is now racing with its US partner, Pfizer, to boost production amid fears of a European gap left by the lack of other approved vaccines. The Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine was the first to be approved by the bloc late last month, after being accepted by the United Kingdom, Canada, and the United States. They and other countries have also since approved the Moderna and the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine, leaving the European Union trailing behind. With criticism growing of the slow pace of the European Union's vaccine program, Ugur Shaheen, the head of the German biotech firm BioNTech, told Der Spiegel that the order process in Europe certainly did not go as fast and as smooth as it did with other countries. Ugur Shaheen, who founded BioNTech with his wife, Özlem Türeci, the firm's chief medical officer, said the situation was not rosy, as the European Union had wrongly assumed several different vaccines would be ready at once, so spread its orders. The assumption was that many other companies would come up with their vaccines, Shaheen said. It would seem that the impression was, we'll get enough, it won't be so bad, and we have this under control. It surprised me. Türeci told the magazine the EU had assumed there would be a basket of different suppliers to choose from. Such an approach makes sense, but then at some point it became clear that many would be unable to deliver so quickly, she said. By that time, it was too late to make up for under-ordering. The United States ordered 600 million doses of the BioNTech Pfizer vaccine in July, while the European Union waited until November to order half as many. Shaheen said the firms were now working flat out to increase production and fill a hole due to a lack of other approved vaccines. He said BioNTech aimed to get a new manufacturing plant up and running in Marburg, Germany this February, far earlier than planned. It should be able to produce 250 million doses in the first half of 2021. Türeci said the firm had also signed deals with five other pharmaceutical companies in Europe to increase production and were negotiating with others. By the end of January, we should have clarity on how much more we can produce, Shahin said. The Moderna vaccine should be cleared on 6th of January by the European Medicines Agency, EMA, which is under mounting pressure to quickly approve the Oxford vaccine, which was cleared this week by Britain. Delays in producing and distributing the BioNTech Pfizer vaccine have caused consternation in Germany, where the focus has been on immunizing elderly people in care homes, and some regions have had to halt vaccination programs within days of starting them. Germany's health minister, Jens Spahn, said earlier this week he had been bombarded with mail from people complaining about citizens not getting quick enough access to the vaccine, despite it being made in Germany. The health minister, Jens Spahn, defended the European Union health minister's decision to take a united approach rather than each country operating alone, arguing that having a united front meant smaller, less wealthy member states could have access to it at the same time as wealthier nations. Germany's health minister, Jens Spahn, said Germany, which has so far inoculated 130,000 people, had taken delivery of 1.3 million doses of the vaccine so far. But some of the 400-plus vaccine centers have had to temporarily close due to a lack of supplies. There have been similar complaints in France, where just 322 people have been vaccinated so far, prompting the French government to promise that healthcare workers aged over 50 could get the vaccine from Monday, sooner than originally planned. Italy has so far vaccinated 8,300 people, and Spain said it was on track to have administered 1.3 million doses of the vaccine. A spokesperson for the French government, Gabriel Attal, defended the pace of France's campaign on Friday, saying it was targeting care homes for the elderly and was not going to judge a vaccination campaign that will last 6 months on a few days. France's health minister, Olivier Véran, announced on Thursday evening that the vaccine would be made available earlier than planned to older healthcare workers. Ministers and officials had been accused of pandering to anti-vaxxers by going too slowly. Some of you have questioned the rhythm of the COVID-19 vaccination program in France a few days after it began in Europe, Olivier Véran, the health minister, said. He tweeted, "Some countries have already vaccinated a lot, others haven't started. Be reassured, the vaccine campaign will soon pick up speed. The vaccine is a historic opportunity to end this epidemic and return to normal life, and we will not miss it." In his New Year address, French President Emmanuel Macron said he will not allow an unjustified delay in the inoculation of the population to happen for bad reasons. President Macron called on people to trust their doctors and scientists. French officials have admitted they were taking a marathon, not a sprint approach to vaccination after running into strong public opposition. A European-wide opinion poll by Ipsos showed that only 40% of the French public questioned said they were willing to have a COVID-19 jab. France says those receiving the vaccine must give written consent after being fully informed of possible side effects of the vaccine and time to consider whether they want it or not. Opposition politicians and doctors have criticized this approach. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. Economic divide.
...2020, a year that will no doubt go down in history as one of the most memorable and one that many actually want to forget. The arrival of the COVID-19 virus not only had an impact on the lives of the people that caught the virus, but has also torn a hole in the global economy, impacting aviation, the stock market, the leisure industry, and of course, the retail industry, which saw lockdowns really hit hard.
No restaurants, no hotels, no cafes and cinemas and things, no tourists. That's going to have a huge impact on us this year, I'm sure. And other things is just really hoping things tick over and we can make our way through and we survive it all. I think that's the most important thing to us at the moment. We're not really looking beyond that.
Well, this year has also seen a shakeup in the corridors of the White House in the United States, with incumbent President Donald Trump suffering a landslide defeat against the president-elect Joe Biden. Yet, in spite of the results, is something that Trump and his supporters refused to accept, claiming monumental fraud.
This has a long way to go. This has a long way to go. You're going to find tremendous fraud. You're going to find fraud of hundreds of thousands of votes per state. You're going to find fraud of many, many times the votes that I need. Again, we're not talking about less votes where, 20 votes, but it doesn't turn the election. No, we're talking about thousands and thousands of votes beyond what we need to turn a state.
Hello and welcome to Economic Divide with me, Kavit Tahwe. In this episode, the final one of the year 2020, we're going to take a look back at some of the major stories that hit the front pages throughout the year and remind ourselves of just how difficult a year 2020 was. Joining me in the studio today in this end-of-the-year special is Mahan Abedin and Atefe Padidar. Well, many thanks to both of you for being in this end-of-the-year special. Mahan, first over to you, the main story that stood out for you for the year 2020.
Well, obviously the corona crisis, but beyond that, it's how disjointed the world is.
And for you?
I think the global market crash caused by this pandemic was one of the main events of 2020.
everything surrounding COVID obviously has had this kind of impact. In terms of what has occurred, we're going to obviously look at COVID. Mahan and Atifa are going to be with us throughout the show as we look back on this year. First, let's take a look at our first recap, which no doubt was the biggest news of 2020. Of course, what we just talked about, the COVID-19 pandemic.
When reports started emerging from the district of Wuhan that a virus had started causing flu-like symptoms, breathing difficulties, and in some cases, death, nobody really considered just what would happen next. On December the 19th, 2019, COVID-19 was named, and the consequences have caused over 1.7 million deaths and nearly 80 million infections worldwide. Yet it was not just the human impact that caused devastation. COVID-19 brought with it one of the most difficult years in recent history. Medical institutions soon found themselves overwhelmed with a significant increase in high-demand patients, all whilst facing PPE shortages and seeing that medical teams themselves were becoming infected with the virus. But it was the impact on the economy which brought a second layer of misery to many people, with multiple companies, businesses, and trades all collapsing at a rate of knots rarely seen, with national GDPs slipping by as much as 25% in some nations. The aviation industry ground to a halt, with flights cancelled, jobs lost, routes wound down, all leading to many airlines either seeking huge multi-billion dollar government bailouts or going bust altogether. With the promise of the vaccine just around the corner, what now remains to be seen is the recovery time to a return to normal. Yet with the mammoth logistical task of distributing the vaccine to over 7.8 billion people around the world, it may well be longer than we all wish for.
Time now to take a look back at one of our esteemed guests, YouTuber Dan Goss, also known as Nonstop Dan, and remind ourselves of what he said about the impact of the coronavirus on one of the worst hit industries.
So the impact on the aviation industry is obviously huge. We have never really seen anything happen like this before, and it's pretty crazy how fast things are changing. Because just a few weeks ago, I was flying Singapore Airlines, and I was talking to the crew about the situation, whether they were worried, what the airline was doing, and they said that we feel pretty confident about this. We managed SARS pretty well, so they felt like they kind of practiced and they knew what was coming. But just a few days later, the airline revealed massive cuts to their routes. And I think this is something we're seeing all across the industry, and airlines are not prepared for this. They had no idea the scale that this would reach, and we still don't really know how big the scale will be and how long it will last. So it's a scary time for airlines in many ways, and especially for the employees, not really knowing now that many of them are being sent on involuntary leave, not knowing when or if they'll get to come back to their jobs.
Okay, obviously many layoffs there. Atifa, let me start with you here. What Dan Goss said there, there are a whole range of industries that have been affected because of this COVID-19, suffering the impact that has been so widespread. Of course, not to mention the devastating loss of lives because of it. Do you think that there's finally a light at the end of the tunnel that we're seeing right now, especially with the announcement of the vaccine? And how long will it take for things to return back to normal, you think?
Well, a vaccine is definitely a good news, but we have to understand that not every country has started the vaccination, and it will take a month, perhaps a year, for everyone across the globe get vaccinated. And a lot of experts say that 2021, the winter of 2021, is going to be the time when things are finally going to move toward becoming normal. But I believe that we cannot call that normal, the life that we knew before this pandemic is over, and things have changed. There's going to be a new normal mm-hmm. after this pandemic.
Okay, Mahan, it seems that the vaccines that are being introduced are from at least two of the big pharmaceutical companies. What are the names here? Pfizer and AstraZeneca. We're all too familiar with pharmaceutical companies. Of course, their main intention to cure people, but what's behind their intention? Do you think that the rollout of the vaccine is just another big money-making opportunity for these pharmaceuticals?
Yes, but that would be the obvious answer. That's what pharmaceutical companies do all the time. They want to make money, and no one can begrudge them for that. The same arguments are made during the AIDS issue all those years ago, that they're trying to make money at the expense of people and other diseases and pandemics. I think the real issue here is the disparity in the people getting the vaccine, the rich-poor divide, or more specifically this time, the north-south divide. So you see the Western countries, led by the UK, have rushed into getting the vaccine done. The EU started today, the Americans a few days ago. They're going to have people vaccinated. Whereas in other countries in the world, vaccination is slow to start.
All right, let's now take a look at another huge story that rocked the year 2020, namely the economic and political issues affecting the U.S. From trade wars with China to racial inequality, they all had a massive impact on the U.S. economy and ultimately on Donald Trump.
As the world's largest economy, many would have speculated that 2020 would have been a good year for the US. After all, President Donald Trump has taken reasonable steps to build up the American economy from the inside out. Yet 2020 brought with it multiple events that would change the ideas of many. Naturally, the coronavirus played a huge part in the year, with millions of Americans infected by the virus. Having the highest death rate in the world also didn't help. And of course, the subsequent impact on the US economy, with furlough schemes and payouts all failing to truly hit the mark. Following this was a series of stock market crashes, oil price crashes, and various collapses in trade, all linked to the various events. Donald Trump also lost his ties with China following a bitter trade war, and yet, in spite of numerous efforts to plaster the cracks over, China and the US have become trade rivals, sparking off a host of bitter words by Trump towards China, including calling COVID-19 the Chinese virus. Trump's racist views soon became reflected at home. Following the brutal murder of George Floyd by police officers, Trump failed to take assertive action by condemning the act, sparking off the Black Lives Matter movement, which soon spread to a global phenomenon. It seems that Trump's failure to effectively deal with the COVID-19 crisis, as well as his poor handling of the BLM movement, it ultimately cost him his job, as Joe Biden swept to a landslide victory in the presidentials, something that Trump still finds a bitter pill to swallow.
Earlier in the year, we were joined by Professor Robert Elliott from the University of Birmingham, and he spoke about the ongoing trade war between China and the U.S. Let's remind ourselves of just what he said.
There's very little willingness on the part of the U.S. to punish China at this stage due to concerns about the economic impact that any breakdown in relations would have on the, you know, the global economy is already struggling due to the pandemic. So, where are we? We're in election year. Trump has still a lot to gain from being tough on China. But of course, with an economy in free fall, it's going to be very difficult. He's got a very difficult balancing act to perform at the moment.
Not much of an act anymore for him. I think he's going to be outgoing. Okay, let me start with you, Mahan. Sure. The big news this year was not only the economic impact of the virus, but also the failure of Donald Trump to not only contain it, but also seems like to win a second term in office. Do you think that Joe Biden can bring something new to the table, especially when it comes to China? Is it going to be a different approach than what Donald Trump had?
Well, he'll definitely have a softer tone. But however, in terms of the actual policies and the general U.S. approach to China, I don't think so. Because the policies are obviously set by the institutions. And the key U.S. institutions, you know, the Pentagon, the CIA, the State Department, in addition to the whole kind of, you know, American apparatus, they're very Sinophobic right now for a good reason. China is catching up. Mm-hmm. Not only catching up, but by 2028 is going to supersede the U.S. as the world's leading economy.
Kept up with the news that just came out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Good. Okay, out of it to you. The Black Lives Matter movement, that was another big story, obviously, for this past year. Economic inequality, amongst other things, were highlighted by them. What legacy will Trump have left as a president that perhaps is negative, that many say led to the division of the U.S., that maybe Joe Biden needs to then pick up the pieces?
Well, definitely Trump divided America. That's his legacy. And I think for Biden, whatever he wants to do when he becomes the president, first things first, he has to bridge the gap between white Americans and not white Americans. He has to unite the United States once again.
Very well. Now, Europe will be also seeing a major economic shift, namely in the shape of Brexit. Let's take a look at the latest development there and look back at a year of extensions and frustrations for the Brexit negotiating teams.
In 2016, Britain went to the polls and voted to leave the European Union. The term Brexit was soon dubbed and became major news for the next 4 years. Following the vote, negotiations began to take place between the UK and the EU as to just how Britain would leave the bloc, with many people in the UK pushing for a so-called no-deal Brexit, believing that Britain did not need to deal with the EU and were quite capable of going it alone. However, the reality of a no-deal soon set in, with businesses realising that without the EU trade benefits, things would get a lot tougher in Britain. Many multinational corporations, including major banks and European medicines agencies, downsized or left the UK altogether following the vote, putting thousands of jobs at risk and giving a taste of things to come. With the majority of Britain's food coming from the EU, supermarket shelves began to empty, prices began to increase, and concerns about the free movement of people and access to labour all played a part in a post-Brexit trauma. Recently, talks stalled and failed on multiple occasions as the end of the transition period came near, with Britain attempting to stand firm against the EU on fishing rights, fair competition and trade rules, with many EU figures vying to make an example of the UK to others. Yet it seems, during extra time of play, the EU and Britain finally settled on a deal, as announced on Christmas Eve by Boris Johnson and Ursula von der Leyen. However, the terms and conditions are still very shady, with the north of Ireland essentially being handed to the Republic of Ireland on a plate, hardliner Brexiteers reeling at Johnson, and indications suggesting that even the deal announced will have a huge negative impact on the British GDP. It seems that Brexit only ever spelt a lose-lose situation for Britain, who now find themselves alone and begging for business.
One of the most contentious issues surrounding Brexit was the hard border on the island of Ireland. Now, when we covered Brexit earlier this year, we spoke to former Sinn Féin director of publicity as to what he thought would happen. And it seems that in terms of a deal that was struck, well, some of the things that he did say appears to be right.
Of course, there are consequences for whatever direction the British government goes in and whatever it adopts. The European Union and lots of its foreign ministers strongly suspect that Johnson wants to bail out without a deal. And I have explained to your viewers the possible consequences of this in the north if the British government imposes a hard border at the end. Because a hard border, of course, means customs posts being set up, then policemen to protect them, and then soldiers to protect the policemen. And that would be a return of the military presence in the north of Ireland. That would be a recipe for disaster.
Okay. Mahan, to you. The north of Ireland, long been a topic of debate, obviously, in the UK.
Yeah.
Brexit, well, it has come and a deal has been set. But it ignited the Republican movement in Ireland, with many feeling that United Ireland is actually closer than ever because of this Brexit. I mean, what are your thoughts on this?
I think it's within touching distance. Brexit has been a key driver, obviously. And now this post-Brexit trade deal is exacerbating the situation. But there's always been a groundswell for Irish unity. And for the first time ever, you can see connectivity between people in the Republic of Ireland, the political class, I mean, and the Republican movement in the North. They're kind of coming together, not seamlessly. Obviously, there's a lot of division between them. And for the first time in a couple of generations, the Unionist movement in the North of Ireland is in real retreat. These are the pro-British people. And they've obviously dominated political life in Northern Ireland for time immemorial. Mm-hmm. But their grip is loosening. The UK is weaker as a result of Brexit. I mean, the real big issue here is Scottish independence, and that's going to happen very soon.
Well, the Brits are in trouble because the COVID-19 obviously has affected their economy so badly. Then we saw Brexit and what it did. We'll have to wait and see, obviously, post-Brexit, what how it's going to affect the UK. And recently, we just saw the news that the 3,000 trucks that were unable to travel, the aerial shots of that was quite striking. Do you think that Brexit is going to bring more economic hardships for the UK?
Absolutely. The UK has to find new market and investors outside the European Union. Their traditional partners in the EU are not going to be as helpful as they used to be in 2021. The EU wants to make an example of the UK. They want to show the other members of the bloc that it's not going to be a good idea to leave the bloc and stand on your own. So I believe that there's going to be a lot of economic hardship because of this pandemic. The UK cannot make the connection it wants, and so it's going to pressure its citizens. There's going to be more austerities and more economic hardship in the future.
Okay, it's clear that some challenging times lie ahead for the UK, but let's now take a look back at our final topic of this show, the impact of sanctions.
In spite of the world dealing with the terrible effects of the COVID-19 virus, it seems that the year also saw an opportunity for some nations to abuse their power, imposing sanctions on other nations during a global pandemic. The Islamic Republic of Iran, for example, has been placed under sanctions by the US president following his withdrawal from the JCPOA upon taking office. With Iran seeing one of the worst initial rates of infection during the birth of the pandemic, sanctions meant that accessing vital medical supplies to treat patients and protect frontline workers became a challenge to deal with on top of the virus. Iran labeled the sanctions as economic terrorism. However, it also proved that the maximum pressure policy on Iran failed to work as Iran pushed on through to become self-sufficient. Further afield, the US also placed sanctions on the likes of Yemen and Syria, with the former entering what the United Nations called a humanitarian disaster, as famine, drought, and lack of medical supplies meant that innocent victims were dying from a preventable cause, as well as being pounded by US-supplied weapons from the Saudi regime to the north. With Donald Trump as the key author of the sanctions facing a humiliating exit from the White House, what now remains to be seen is whether incoming Joe Biden may take a different view on sanctions and reverse the cruel acts committed by his predecessor.
Earlier in the year, we spoke to Kern Alexander, professor of law, finance, and banking regulations from the University of Zurich in Switzerland. Let's remind ourselves as to what he said about sanctions.
Well, sanctions have historically been used by countries as instruments of foreign policy. And in countries, the effectiveness of sanctions depends really on the extent and influence of a country's economy. So the United States, of course, comes in for a lot of criticism for its use of economic sanctions because the U.S. economy is large and many countries want to trade with the U.S. But the downside of that is that when the U.S. wants to try to get its way in foreign policy, it will restrict access to its economy with its trade relations with other countries. And so and that has a negative impact on diplomacy, and it has a negative impact also on certain groups in foreign countries.
Okay, let me turn to you first, Atifeh. Economic sanctions, obviously, it has been described by some. I'm looking at Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, who called it economic terrorism.
So, and obviously Iran being a country that has suffered so much from these sanctions, they, as our guest even alluded to there, said it, ability for various countries to gain access to vital resources, it has restricted that, and medicine, humanitarian supplies or goods in general is one of the areas that has been restricted. Do you think that the U.S. has used sanctions to actually exert pressure on these countries?
Definitely. As it was mentioned on our interview, the United States always used this strategy to pressure certain countries, not just the U.S. Some of its Western allies used the same strategy. We saw examples in Iraq and Libya when these countries were under heavy sanctions by U.S. and some other countries like France and